These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 7th, 2018. Tonight, we're going to delve into three separate topics ranging from police officers on bikes to what is considered a rare and often misdiagnosed respiratory disease. First, Russ Rader, who's the Senior Vice President for Communications at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, joins me. The IIHS is an independent, nonprofit scientific and educational organization dedicated to reducing the losses, deaths, injuries, and property damage from motor vehicle crashes. In addition, the Highway Loss Data Institute shares and supports that mission through scientific studies of insurance data representing the human and economic losses resulting from the ownership and operation of different types of vehicles and by publishing insurance loss results by vehicle make and model. So with more than 800 cyclists killed in 2017, Russ and I talk about what the data show and what the Institute is recommending to automobile makers. We also discuss the crash in Arizona that killed the pedestrian walking her bike across the street when an autonomous vehicle struck her. After a break, Ren Neely, who is a police officer, a paramedic, and the president of IPIMBA, International Police Mountain Bike Association, gives us an overview of what police officers on bikes do and how they do it. So did you know that there are emergency medical techs who ride mountain bikes, often being able to get to places an ambulance or car cannot? Lastly, Dr. Albert Rizzo, who is the senior medical advisor of the American Lung Association, as well as the section chief of pulmonology medicine at the Christiana Care Health System in Newark, Delaware, and the leading medical authority for the Lung Association, talks with us about idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, often difficult to diagnose and sometimes mistaken for COPD. IPF is a chronic lung disease that is characterized by a progressive and irreversible decline in lung function. The disease occurs in more men than women, and there are few treatments available. This week, the Lung Association published an article talking about IPF and the need for more research. Without further ado, let's head on over to Arlington, Virginia, and talk statistics and recommendations for better safety with Russ Rader from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Hi, Russ. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time to speak with me today.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it is my pleasure. I want you to tell us about the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, what it does and why it does it, and what your position there is.
Sure. Well, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety is a nonprofit highway safety research organization. We are funded entirely by the automobile insurance industry with the mission of finding ways to reduce the deaths, injuries, and property damage that result from motor vehicle crashes. My job is communications here. That is also part of our mission, is to communicate our findings to the public and to policymakers.
So then there's another division, the Highway Loss Data Institute. What does that do, and how does that work with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, the IIHS?
The HLDI also supports the Institute's mission. What HLDI does is they collect, analyze, and publish insurance claim data, which is an important part of our research program, because we can use that data to identify vehicles that are crashing more than others, and we can also look at that data to see how various new technologies on vehicles are working.
I think I contacted the right guy.
We have lots and lots of information on road safety.
And that is what we're talking about. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about the safety of vulnerable road users, cyclists and pedestrians especially.
Yep.
I know you've collected some data about crashes that involve cyclists and pedestrians. What kinds of data is that?
Well, we are very interested in studying this area. Our new president, Dr. David Harkey, who came from the University of North Carolina, is especially interested in this area, so it has long been a focus of our research and will be even more so in the future, I'm sure. One of the things that we look at is we look at the data looking at how people are injured or killed in crashes, including cyclists and pedestrians. So, for example, one of the things that is very concerning in the latest fatal crash data that we have for 2016 is that 835 cyclists died in crashes involving motor vehicles in 2016, and that's the highest number since 1991. And we're also seeing big increases in pedestrian deaths, almost 6,000 deaths, and that's up 46% since the low point about 7 years ago.
Okay, those are not happy numbers.
No, they're not. They're very concerning. And what's one of the things that I always point out to people is that, you know, motor vehicles have gotten much safer for their occupants over time. With crash testing and all of that, vehicles are a lot safer when they crash for the people inside them. But what that means is that the pedestrian and bicycle problem, crashes and injuries and deaths, for those vulnerable road users has become a bigger part of the overall traffic safety problem. So it merits a lot of close scrutiny to see how we can reduce those numbers.
Well, I noticed that one of the areas of discussion on the IIHS site is about crash avoidance features and other vehicle improvements. So what are some of these features and improvements that are for crash avoidance? Especially.
Well, this is an area that shows a lot of promise for reducing pedestrian and bicyclist deaths and injuries. If you could have technology on vehicles that can detect when there is an obstacle in the roadway, when there is a pedestrian crossing the road, when there is a bicycle along the path of the motor vehicle, and alert the driver that there is an imminent collision, or even take action for the driver to avoid the crash, that is an area that we are very interested in looking at. We did a study several years ago looking at the scenarios in which bicyclists are killed. And the most common one, about 46% of the deaths, is when a bicycle and a motor vehicle are traveling along in the same direction. The motor vehicle comes up behind the bicyclist and strikes the bicyclist. That's the most common fatal crash scenario for bicyclists. And that would be a very straightforward scenario for crash avoidance technology on vehicles to detect that situation, alert the driver, or take action, because those crash avoidance systems are typically tuned to recognize a vehicle ahead they could also be modified to recognize a bicyclist.
Wow, that would be awesome, wouldn't it?
It would be, and in fact, we already have that happening. We have some Volvo and Subaru vehicles can recognize bicyclists in the vehicle's path and warn the driver and even automatically brake the vehicle if the driver doesn't take action.
Do you know if there's any statistic about a driver coming? So a cyclist and a driver are coming up, along the same way. They're both traveling in the same direction. And the motor vehicle overtakes the cyclist and makes a right turn. We call it a right hook. Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how many of those incidents you're aware of or have statistics about, but are they doing any research about making something change there? I don't know what you'd change, though.
Well, that is something, you know, there are a number of different scenarios that lead to fatal crashes, and there are going to be limitations for this crash avoidance technology. So, you know, we need to look at other kinds of strategies. One of the limitations of the crash avoidance systems is that they don't operate as well or not at all in darkness. And we know that a lot of these crashes happen at night. So we're going to need more sophisticated sensors in order to prevent more of these crashes. Our estimate is that if we could get these systems on all vehicles, we could prevent as many as half of the fatal crashes involving bicycles.
Wow. That's a huge, huge improvement. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Russ Rader. I hope I said that correctly.
Absolutely, yep.
He is with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. We are talking about bicycle and pedestrian crashes and cars. So are you looking at distracted and impaired driving? Do you have statistics that are seeing distracted and impaired driving?
Yes. I mean, we do a lot of research in that area. Impaired driving is has long been and continues to be one of the biggest problems that we have on the road. About a quarter to a third of fatal crashes involve at least one vehicle driver who is impaired by alcohol. So that's big. That's a big number. It's, you know, in the 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 people killed range. Distracted driving is a little bit more of a conundrum because we know it's a big problem. We don't have good statistics on it. And that's because drivers who are in crashes are not likely to admit to a police officer or to their insurance company that they were on the phone or using a device in some way. So that's a difficult one to gauge, but it's a big problem.
Yeah, I'm wondering. One of the things I know is that they have a way to lock out an impaired driver. Is there a way to lock out these phones when they can't? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we're looking at some of the systems that the carriers are making available on their phones to block phone calls, texts when a vehicle is in motion. And we're looking at how well those systems work, for one, and also how drivers react to them. Do they use them if they're available? That's one of the areas we're researching now.
Yeah, my husband thinks that the coolest thing, or the thing that maybe should be done, is that the insurance companies should raise the rates of people who don't use them and lower the rates of people who do use these if they're available.
Right.
Which, you know, that is an incentive. But for some people, like teenagers, it seems like there is no incentive to get their phones away from them. So we've now encountered our first fatality with an autonomous vehicle. Are you looking at the future of these types of vehicles? Where is that going? That's pretty scary right now.
Yeah, it's something we're looking at. The government is also investigating that crash that happened in Arizona. We don't know what went wrong there. There probably in crashes, there usually are multiple things that go wrong. That Volvo was equipped with what's known as a LIDAR system, which is a laser-based system for detecting things ahead of the vehicle. And LIDAR works, unlike the technology we were talking about a minute ago, LIDAR works in the dark. And so it should have detected the pedestrian walking the bicycle, and we don't know why it either didn't see her or why it may have misinterpreted what it was seeing. So that's something the investigators are going to be looking at. That said, you know, automation has a lot of potential. Even despite this crash, we know that automation has a lot of potential. Technology has a lot of potential to prevent these crashes, but it has to work. And so that's something the investigators are going to be looking at very carefully.
Yeah, I am sure. I am sure. So does the IIHS make recommendations or otherwise advise insurance, government, or the auto industry, or do you just do this statistical work and hand it over?
Yeah, we advocate for the safety systems and the safety policies that work, and we provide that information to the automakers, to our insurance supporters, to policymakers in the government, and we do that constantly with the research that we do.
So, what are some of the new areas that you're looking at right now? Are there some new ideas that are coming in line?
Well, we're doing a lot of research on new vehicle technology. We have a vehicle research center in Virginia where we do research looking at automated systems on vehicles. So that's an area that is growing. And we're doing some research on bicycle helmets, which will be coming out in the next couple of months. We have a partnership with Virginia Tech University looking at that. We're also doing some new research on pedestrians. Similar to the study I mentioned on bicycle crash scenarios, we are looking at the scenarios in which pedestrians are killed in collisions with motor vehicles, with an eye toward figuring out how we can advise cities on how to best prevent those collisions.
Wow. It's a big, really field of information. I had no idea that all this research is going on. Obviously, it needs to go on. More people are driving, that's a really good question, Diane. I'm glad you asked that. Are more people driving or are fewer? We are told that fewer people are driving, but somehow I don't think that's true.
No, and this is one of the reasons that crashes are going up across the country in the last few years, is that there are more people are driving more miles. And what happens after a recession, and we went through a very deep recession back in 2008, 2009, what happens when the economy bounces back is there's more driving and there's more risky driving, because people who feel better about their jobs are more likely to do things like go on long vacations and drive on unfamiliar roads, or go out on the weekends to the tailgate parties or to the bars. And so you get a lot more risky driving when the economy is good, and that's part of what's happening now.
Wow, that's interesting. Who would have even thought of that? But that's what you guys do. Very interesting.
Yep.
Well, how can listeners find out more about your work, the work of the IIHS and the HLDI?
Well, you can find out more by going to our website, which is IIHS.org, and you can see all of the most recent research and go to the topic of bicycles and pedestrians, and you can see everything that we've done on that, and we'll be adding to that during 2018.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. I had no idea, as I said, that all this research is going on, and some of it in our favor from the cyclist perspective, and we do appreciate that work. Thank you so much for talking with me today, and I hope we can find some solutions to some of these really, really sad problems.
Now, I'll keep you posted on the new research, and be happy to talk some more about it when it's ready to be released.
Do you have any idea of when that might be?
Well, I know that the pedestrian research that we're working on will be ready likely in May. And then we have some more work that we're doing on crash avoidance technology and bicycles and pedestrians later in 2018.
Okay, we will stay in touch. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Diane.
All
appreciate
right.
it.
You have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Russ Rader joined me from the offices of the IIHS. For more information and to look at the new studies coming online on cyclist and pedestrian safety, log on to IIHS.org. So let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to speak with Officer Ren Neely about IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Bike Association. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Are back, and it's off to Texas to speak with Officer Ren Neely and learn about police who do their jobs on mountain bikes and how they do it. Hello, Ren. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Good to hear from you.
I want to talk to you about all the work that you do, and you do a lot of work. And so in an effort to move our conversation and actions for the safety of cyclists forwards, I contacted, all right, now I always get this wrong, it's IPMBA, International Police Mountain Bike Association, and they gave me you because you're the president. So tell us a little bit about you, what you do, because you're not just president of that organization. You also work for the Cypress Creek EMS, and give us sort of a background on police and bicycles.
Okay, so I work for Cypress Creek EMS. I'm a paramedic and the director of special operations. So that includes lots of different things, basically everything that doesn't pertain to actual 911 ambulance calls. The most relative to our discussion today is our EMS bike medic response team. I'm also a reserve lieutenant with the Waller County Sheriff's Office and helped start their bike team several years ago, and serve as the president for IPIMBA, in addition to some other duties that I have in relation to public safety.
Sounds like you don't have enough to do, right?
Correct.
So, wait, I want to back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about this bicycle team that does EMS work.
Yes. So at Cypress Creek, we have a team of about 32 to 34 paramedics and EMTs, both volunteer and career EMS personnel that work from the mountain bike at special events, large mass gatherings, and basically anywhere that a normal conventional EMS response to a casualty or a patient would be delayed, because riding a bicycle, you can, with the proper training, you can ride a bicycle anywhere that you can walk. So they typically can access patients a lot faster at these mass gatherings and some of these unique venues like Ironman triathlons and professional golf championship events.
Interesting. So what kind of things does a bicycle EMT, I guess, would be the proper an emergency medical technician, what would he or she carry on the bike?
So it ranges from basic life support bandages and bleeding control devices all the way up to full paramedic ALS, advanced life support care. And just based on the jurisdiction and what the protocol is, here at Cypress Creek, we send out a team of two medics, one of which has to be a paramedic, and so that gives them a full advanced life support capability, and they carry all of the equipment and medications, defibrillator, a portable computer for patient care reporting, and they can work everything from a fall and a minor injury, scraped knee, all the way up to a cardiac arrest.
Wow. Who knew? That's so interesting. So what kind of training goes into becoming an officer on a bicycle, whether forgetting EMS for a moment? Obviously, they have to go through all the medical training. But let's just take a standard IPIMBA, International Police Mountain Bike rider, and tell me what kind of training goes into getting out of a car and getting on a bike.
At IPIMBA, we offer a pretty comprehensive training program for police, EMS, and security cyclists. that have roots in bike handling and vehicular cycling skills. The course is not designed to teach them to be a police officer or a medic or a security officer. They come to us with that training and capability. Students learn how to operate the bicycle in very slow speed and with precise technique to ride up and down stairs or curbs, avoid obstacles, ride safely and legally in traffic. They also practice mission-specific things such as patrol procedures for law enforcement and tactics and EMS scene safety and defensive measures for medics. There's also specific firearms, bike-specific firearms training program for police officers and armed security officers. And at Pima, we consider public safety bicycle training to be the EVOC for bikes, which is the Emergency Vehicle Operations course, which is pretty much the standard for public safety agencies to provide training certification for their personnel to operate emergency vehicles. So riding on a bike on duty is very different than your recreational cycling. And so just like operating a police car or an ambulance is different than driving your car, it requires type-specific training.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ren Neely. He is the president of IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Bike Association. He is also with the Cypress Creek EMS in Texas. So do people, are police officers are already police officers, do they volunteer to do a bike patrol or are they chosen? What's the process there?
It depends on the agency, but for the most part, yes, they do volunteer. Bike patrols are often considered a specialty team or specialty assignment, and therefore are very competitive to be able to get onto those such teams. Being on a bike requires physical exertion and a desire for interaction and with the public close up, often in non-enforcement type situations, speaking for law enforcement. And some agencies hold specific tryouts before they allow those officers to and medics to become a member of that team. Personnel may need to have certain degrees of experience as an EMS officer or a patrol officer, and that's typically dependent upon the agency and their protocol. And then they may have to conduct a physical agility test or tryout and a oral interview for the position on the team.
So do women volunteer for this too?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Just a question. You know, I'm thinking about bike riding and the difference between women riders and men riders and, you know, smaller mountain bikes, larger mountain bikes and all that, having been in a bike shop for years and years and years. So do you know how many bike patrols there might be around the country? I know that's really a hard question perhaps, but given we have 52 states and we have all these different cities and organizations, I know we have a bike patrol in the small city I live in, which is right out. It's a suburb of Cleveland. Do you know how many there might be?
So the current statistics are not readily available, but we understand that the U.S. Bureau of Justice and Statistics will be releasing a report later this year updating that data about bike patrols and the use of bikes in public safety. The most current stats are available on the IPIMBA website at www.ipmba.org, and they go back to the last year that it was compiled and released, which was 2007. So about 4,000 of the nation's approximately 13,000 police departments, 270 of approximately 3,000 sheriff's departments, and 725 of approximately 905 campus law enforcement agencies deploy bikes on a routine basis as part of their daily operations.
Is that growing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that a lot of the work that police departments do relates to crime, but I'm wondering how often a bicycle cop, and I don't hope that's not a bad word, bike cop, is that a good term, or is there a better one?
Sure. I mean, officer is...
Oh, okay. Officer. I like that better. It's less pejorative, I think. has been called to, now I know this is very specific and you may not know this, has been called to a scene where a cyclist has been hit. I mean, obviously this is a big area of concern for the cycling community. So many cyclists and pedestrians are being hit by, you know, either distracted drivers, drivers under the influence, pissed off drivers. I mean, that's one of my favorite. Do you know how many times a bicycle officer has responded to these kind of things or is responding?
You know, that's really going to be dependent upon the jurisdiction and if they have a full-time bike unit, like some of your larger cities, due to the congestion in the inner city, will deploy full, you know, officers on a regular routine patrol in the inner city. And so if they're available, they and close enough, which brings me to the point that it's really dependent upon, or the next big factor is the type of vehicle that the officer is responding in. So at the time of the call and the distance that they have to travel to get to that, you know, incident.
True.
Obviously, if the collision occurs in an area with routine bike patrols, it's going to be easier to get a bike officer there.
Sure.
And get them there quickly. So it's just, I mean, I personally was teaching a IPIMBA class and had our students riding through a local community neighborhood, right, in typical neighborhood speeds. And the class was nearly hit by a vehicle that came flying around the corner. And we ultimately were able to get the vehicle stopped. And the responding sheriff's deputy happened to be a full-time bike officer who just that day happened to be in a patrol car. So we were very fortunate to get a bike officer to respond to that incident. And I think it was purely coincidental, in fact. But he definitely handled that a little differently because he was very well aware of the laws as they pertain to cyclists in the road and operating in the road and so forth. So
you are aware, I can hear it from what your response was to that question, you are aware that oftentimes, or at least sometimes, police officers are not always very friendly to cyclists in terms of the rules of the road and may not actually, in certain jurisdictions, believe the cyclist who does tend to know the rules of the road and tell them to do things like ride on the sidewalk. I know that you would not encounter that yourself because you understand what the rules of the road are, but I think officers in cars often do not. Do you know that that's true?
Well, there's...
I know. This is a tough one.
I wouldn't agree just blanketly that all officers that work from a patrol car are not friendly to cyclists.
Oh, no. I would never say that. I agree with you. I understand.
So it's they may not be aware of the specific laws as they pertain to bicyclists operating in the roadway. And so a lot of agencies who have full-time bike units, usually part of that, their duty is to help try and educate through in-service training and so forth their counterparts in some of those bike-specific laws and cycling issues. I know that we have worked at the sheriff's office where I'm a reserve lieutenant. When we started the bike team there, we had to educate the rest of the department because they were not familiar with that small section of the traffic code. They unfortunately get a lot more time and training and experience in dealing with the rest of the traffic code that typically can sometimes get glossed over.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Ren Neely. He is the president of IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Bike Association, and he does a whole bunch of other stuff. He wears like 10 different hats. So do people who drive cars and see you on your bike behave differently? Do you see them suddenly like straightening up and slowing down and doing things like that?
Ideally, all motorists should treat cyclists with respect and courtesy, whether or not they're a uniformed police officer or bike medic officer, right? So, but there really isn't a lot of proof of this. It's, I can speak from my experience that when I've ridden on bike patrol as a police officer, they typically don't even realize you're a police officer, even though you're dressed in a very distinctive law enforcement uniform.
It says police on the back, usually.
The bike is tricked out with lights and extra bags that say police or sheriff's department, and your shirt says it, and you're wearing a gun belt and a helmet and a badge and all of this stuff, and they just totally don't even see that. They see you as a cyclist.
How interesting. And that's not always good. I want them to see us as, maybe we should all be wearing police uniforms. That would be awesome. Of course, that would really screw things up. That's illegal.
From the law enforcement side, we have been able to ride up to criminal activity, and they don't even realize that you're a police officer.
Well, that's a good thing then.
It can be good and it can be bad. It's good in the sense it allows you to get that close to capture and detain them and investigate the crime. And the bad thing is they could not understand that you're the police, and therefore they could respond in a violent manner in which would tend to escalate things, right? So
yeah,
they don't realize that they're fighting the police until it's too late, or that they've run from, or so forth. So it's got some positives and some negatives.
You guys must have some really interesting stories to tell one another. I just can't even imagine. So one of the things we're encountering as cyclists, and I'm saying this rather broadly, is that it's often difficult to get a statement from a cyclist who's been hit because he or she's being whisked off to hospital. So what do you do, and how do you follow up on those kinds of things to find all the facts? So what we're finding is a lot of these cases, because they don't have a cyclist statement, and we're finding that some police departments are closing those cases without that statement because they don't have time. They don't have the resources to go to the hospital or after the fact. How do you answer that as far as you can tell as a cyclist? You know, what would you suggest that the police do to make these cases more fair and make sure that the right person is being prosecuted?
You know, it's really not any more difficult than obtaining a statement from an injured party or person from another type of incident, say a assault or a shooting or so forth, where the patient's condition warrants an urgent transport and they can't stay on scene to let the officer conduct that little initial interview. And in those cases, it's really incumbent upon the officer to conduct as part of his or her investigation to go to the hospital and follow up with the cyclist and obtain a statement and conduct their interview and investigate the crash or the collision or the incident. So depending upon the different size departments and the jurisdictions and some of those issues that you know, or influencing factors that you mentioned, it may get pushed to a detective bureau for follow-up or a traffic unit for follow-up. Some departments, especially a bicyclist auto collision, they want their traffic units who have expertise in investigating traffic collisions to handle those. And so they'll refer them to a traffic unit. But at the end of the day, the investigation needs to be conducted thoroughly, and to just close it without speaking with the injured party and the cyclist in this case even by telephone, is unfortunate that that happens and is really avoidable.
We like to think so, but we are seeing more cases like that than we would like to see. We're also seeing a lot of drivers who have either had suspended licenses, distracted, under the influence, being let off in cases where we think that there could have been more done to keep that driver back from getting back behind a wheel again. So, yeah, this is a really, really tough time for cyclists. There are a lot of cases. And unfortunately, because of my position, everybody sends me these stories and they're just really horrific. So what do you think a cyclist needs to do to become a better transportation citizen? Obviously, you guys are really well trained on your bikes. And as you say, you can sneak up on people, you can ride stairs. I'm sure the bike shops love you and all those things. But what can we do as cyclists from your perspective to be better transportation citizens?
So all users of the transportation system really share the same rights and responsibilities. Cyclists need to learn how to ride safely in a vehicular style manner, obey the traffic control devices and not just roll through stop signs or stoplights, and signal their intentions just like if they were driving a vehicle. And although you might think this next one shouldn't apply to cyclists, I've personally seen it. They should refrain from distracted driving. Believe it or not, I've seen cyclists pedaling away and texting on their phone.
I can believe it.
You know, and with the technology and changing, and with the fancy mounts on handlebars to mount smart devices for navigation and to listen to music, and it puts that device readily at the fingertips of the cyclist rather than in their cycle bag or pocket, and so it's easy for them to be distracted. The navigation device is easy to distract the cyclist. So cyclists do have to work to and fight through that same struggle as drivers do with refraining from distracted driving. And then they need to treat drivers of other vehicles with the same courtesy and consideration that they themselves expect. Know the traffic laws and how they pertain to bicycles, because they're different in different jurisdictions, right?
Each
state has some slightly different laws. And be a nice user of the transportation system, right?
Yes, I agree. That's really interesting that you see the distracted driving situation from cyclists. It's sort of like an epidemic. One of the other people I'm going to be speaking with for the show this week is the Highway Safety Insurance Institute. and that's going to be part of our conversation to hear some of these statistics about distracted driving and how horrible what kinds of horrible things it creates. Well, this has just been fascinating. I really hope that someday we're putting together a safety symposium for next spring, and maybe you'd like to come and talk to us about police bicycle mountain bike stuff.
Sure. The mission of IPIMBA is really to promote the use of bikes for public safety purposes by providing resources and networking opportunities to offer the best and most complete comprehensive public safety training for cyclists. And so we're always looking for opportunities to go share our mission and what we do at IPIMBA and how public safety agencies can benefit from utilizing mountain bikes. And now we're looking at e-bikes and so forth to do their job better and safer.
Well, it sounds like we have another conversation to have in the near future. But I really appreciate you talking with me today. I will be in touch. We will talk about e-bikes in the future. That's going to be another big show we're going to be doing. And I will talk with you about the safety symposium. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I always learn new things, and this has been fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You have a wonderful afternoon.
All right. You too.
Bye-bye. Ren Neely joined me from the Cypress Creek EMS unit in Houston, Texas. For more information on IPIMBA, maybe you want to join the force. Log on to ipmba.org. So let's take another short break, and then it's off to the East Coast to speak with Dr. Albert Rizzo about IPF, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back, and it is off to Delaware to speak with Dr. Albert Rizzo. Good morning, Dr. Rizzo. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, I ran across an article titled Why We Need Idiopathic Pulmonary Fibrosis Research Now More Than Ever. It was published by the American Lung Association, and since you're an expert in this area, I thought maybe you could help us to understand what the disease is and why it's often misdiagnosed.
Sure, sure. As a pulmonologist, I've had to put up with the pulmonary fibrosis for quite a few years, and the interesting part is that we hadn't had much to be able to do for patients who were diagnosed with this up until the last few years when some new medications were developed to help slow down the disease. The problem with the disease is it's very insidious in many patients. It doesn't have obvious symptoms and can be very slow in developing, so patients often don't realize they have any symptoms. They feel like they're getting a little older. They may be a little short of breath for that reason. They may cough periodically and think they have allergies. But the cough and the shortness of breath are some of the really early signs that can be an indication that something's brewing in the lungs.
Your background is pulmonology, and that includes a whole host of pulmonary function diseases like asthma and this pulmonary fibrosis and COPD. So oftentimes people get one confused with the other. COPD is often diagnosed instead of IPF?
Exactly. Again, because patients don't realize that they're developing a disease. Now, COPD is often correlated with cigarette smoking, so patients sometimes will think they have a disease related to that. But COPD can certainly be in people who don't smoke, and asthma really can be in anybody, childhood, adult, and can be allergic in nature or not allergic. So there are some differences, certainly, between the asthma and COPD population and the fibrosis. To put it in a somewhat simplistically, asthma and COPD are more conditions that we say are abnormalities in the airways, so flow of air in and out of the lungs. Pulmonary fibrosis is more a stiffening of the lung texture itself. So when we try to take a breath, the lung is harder to expand. It's not so much getting air in and out. It's just that the lung is stiffer. And that's the big difference between a fibrotic condition versus a airways disease like asthma or COPD.
How do you diagnose the difference? How do you find that difference? What kinds of tests can you run?
Well, the first step is certainly to have a level of suspicion that something's wrong. And probably the first test that helps differentiate the two is something called a simple spirometry. And that's a standard pulmonary function test that sometimes isn't used as much as it should in a primary care office or certainly in a hospital clinic, where the patient is put through a few maneuvers, have them take deep breaths as deep as they can, and blow air in and out of their lungs, and make an assessment as to how well that is done compared to what we consider normal for people that age, height, and weight. So that can certainly define a disease as either being a flow problem like asthma or COPD, or potentially a stiffness or a restrictive problem like pulmonary fibrosis. So that's probably one of the first tests. And then the other test that can sometimes be an indication is a simple chest X-ray. But we know that chest X-rays aren't that sensitive and can really be normal in the early stages of all these common for it.
Let me remind our listeners, we are speaking with Dr. Albert Rizzo. He is the senior medical advisor for the American Lung Association. He's the section chief of pulmonary medicine at Christiana Care Health System in Newark, Delaware. Is that right? Yeah,
That's Newark, right?
Yeah. So let's get back to who might be prone to present with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis.
Sure. The typical patient tends to be more in men than women, and usually in the 50, 60, 70-year-olds. So the fifth, sixth, seventh decade of life seems to be when most of these patients present. Now, it is a condition that's considered rare because there's probably under 200,000 people that develop this disease on a yearly basis, if that many. And for that reason, it is something that is not always top of mind when patients present to their physician with some symptoms. There are no causes that we know. That's why the word idiopathic is in that diagnosis. But we know there's associations. Certainly people have smoked, may be more likely to develop this condition. The age group that I mentioned, there also can be some familial or genetic components to this. So family members who've had this diagnosis may lead to brothers or sisters or children who may develop the disease as well.
There is no prevention per se?
Since we don't really know what causes it, the answer is correct. We can't really prevent it. We know that there are the associations I mentioned. So not smoking is always very good for any lung condition. But we really don't know what causes this. So being aware of it and early diagnosis right now tends to be the best way to identify it and potentially offer treatments.
And that's what I want to talk about. So once it is diagnosed, do you have new treatments that are coming online? Tell us what people are able to accomplish now, because it is a progressive disease.
That's correct. It is progressive, and it varies from person to person as to whether it's slowly progressive or rapidly. On average, people once diagnosed with this probably have a life expectancy about 3.5 years. So it's almost as lethal as some cancers that we know of. But it does vary from person to person. We think it's an abnormal healing process in the lung where too much collagen or fibrotic tissue is put down in the lung for reasons that we don't know. Because of that, we know there are two drugs that were released, I believe, in 2014. One is called Esbriet and one is called Ofev. And basically, they work through blocking that abnormal wound healing or fibrosis that we know continues through the years ahead. We don't think these drugs cure it. We do feel that these drugs slow down the process. So that's why it's very important to diagnose this early, because as it progresses, lung function is lost and we never get that back. So once it's diagnosed and we potentially put patients on one of these medications, we can slow down the process and hopefully expand that lifespan that I mentioned earlier.
Really, toward the end of this disease, you're looking at either mortality, or there is no immortality here, or a lung transplant.
That's exactly right. The
other
thing we can offer patients is a lung transplant. Now, that is not an easy thing to offer because not everybody meets the criteria. There are certain age requirements. Certainly patients who have other significant medical problems like heart disease may not be good candidates for it. But lung transplant is something that can be really changing quality of life significantly. Often it's a single or double lung transplant that's required. And my rule of thumb is that when patients are diagnosed with this and start to have symptoms that potentially require oxygen, they should be seen early at a center that is able to offer them the option of a transplant. These centers will be able to identify patients who may be candidates at some point, or may honestly be able to tell a patient that they're not going to be a candidate for transplantation. But the earlier patients know that, the better, so they can understand what the future may hold for them.
I have a question that you may or may not be able to answer, and that's about athletes, because obviously the people who listen to this show are cyclists for the most part. Do you see that being an athlete makes any difference to this idiopathic disease?
Well, hopefully most of the athletes we're talking about are not in that age range where I said this usually presents.
Yeah, they are, though.
in their 50s, 60s,
and 70s. Oh, yeah, that is who listens to this show. Yep.
Right. So I think just because you are an athlete doesn't mean you're immune to this. But the thing is, it will affect your ability to exercise, whether you're a runner, jogger, rower, whatever you do. As that lung process starts to stiffen the lungs, you will notice it. You will not have the capacity to do what you did before. And like a lot of medical conditions, the sooner you notice a change like this, talk to your doctor about it. Don't write it off as just being a year older or a few pounds heavier. The sooner a diagnosis can be made because you notice a change in your quality of life or what you're able to do on a daily basis, the better it's going to be once we find out what that is.
Are you seeing an increase in this disease, or are you just seeing people being diagnosed more accurately?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think there are studies that indicate more people are developing this disease at those stages of life that I mentioned. We honestly don't know why. We do think some people are living a little longer because Maybe their other medical conditions have been treated, their heart disease and things of that nature. So more people in those older age groups are existing with the disease. And the hope is that these newer drugs are also going to make people live longer, so we'll have more patients with it. But that, having said that, it is a matter of diagnosing it sooner. And the diagnosis, we kind of glossed over a little bit. The diagnosis can be tough because patients need to have usually what's called a high-resolution CT scan of the chest to start to identify the abnormalities in this disease. And sometimes that's enough to make the diagnosis, but sometimes these patients need to go on to have a biopsy of the lung, either minimally invasive through a bronchoscopy, or they may actually need to have an open biopsy by way of a thoracic surgeon. So finding out the exact diagnosis is important because other conditions can mimic this, and those other conditions are treated differently.
You know, we always say we're very lucky here in Northeast Ohio. We have the Cleveland Clinic, and they do a lot of this kind of work. I always say it's a good place to be sick, which is kind of a bad thing to say. Wow, this is really kind of a scary thing to talk about, but I'm glad that I discovered the article and that Pat Volz was kind enough to give me your name. Are you treating a lot of these patients right now?
Probably a handful. It's not something that, as I said, it's not that common. We're not necessarily like the Cleveland Clinic where we get people sent to us from outside areas. But and places like the Cleveland Clinic, Hopkins, Penn, those places have large referral centers and tend to have more of them. The important thing about this diagnosis, at a center where you treat it, it's best to have a multidisciplinary approach. So every month we have our thoracic surgeons, pathologists, radiologists, and our pulmonary staff look at these cases on a monthly basis, decide, do we really know what this is? Does this patient need a biopsy or not? And what's going to be the best treatment? So an interdisciplinary approach is the important thing to help make sure we're making the right decision for these patients.
I appreciate you talking to us about it. It's kind of a scary thing, but it would be better to know up front than find out too late that you can't even treat it. So for more information, you can log on to the Lung Association's website. And are there other places where people could go to find out more about IPF, or should they just be when they figure out these symptoms, get to the doctor?
Well, I was going to say that I think the Lung Association website is certainly very good, but this is a disease where if you look too much online at different places, you can get very scared. So if you have questions about this or think you may have symptoms that mimic this, talk to your doctor. I mean, website is good to look at, but talk to your doctor and see what direction they give you.
Great advice, doctor. That is great advice. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Albert Rizzo. He's the senior medical advisor for the American Lung Association. He is the section chief of pulmonary medicine at Christiana Care Health Systems in Newark, Delaware. Thank you so much. And I hope that you see fewer and fewer of these patients as opposed to more and more.
Correct. And thank you for the opportunity to discuss it.
All right. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye. Dr. Albert Rizzo joined me from his office at Christiana Care Pulmonary Associates in Newark, Delaware. For more information about IPF, you can log on to lung.org. But as Dr. Rizzo said, check in with your doctor first. So, wow, I learned a whole lot of stuff this week. I want to thank all three of my guests, Russ Rader from IIHS, Officer Ren Neely from IPIMBA, and Dr. Rizzo. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. We will be back next week with a conversation with Olympic track cycling hopeful Joshua Hartman. In the meantime, I hope you have a safe and happy week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.